Hey, modern explorers, you're listening to Midland, in our own words, a bi-monthly podcast uncovering Midland County's history as told by you, our community and listeners. Each podcast, we'll introduce never-before-heard stories and tales through personal testimonials and memories passed down through generations. Subscribe to our podcast today to further discover the history of Midland County and send us a note if you have a story you'd like to share. This podcast is part of the Midland County Historical Society's Oral History Project. For more information, please visit midlandcenter.org/oral history.
Good morning. I am Jay Cuss with the Midland County Historical Society's Oral History Project, and I am here with Jennifer Boyer. It is 10:28 a.m. on February 10th, 2021. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Jake. How are you?
Good, good. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Sun shining on a cold day.
There you go. That's a fact. 0 degrees out today for anyone listening to this in the future, I tell you. So, Jennifer, let's jump right into it. Can you give a little bit of background on yourself and then lead up into your position with Midland County?
I am the Emergency Management Coordinator here for Midland County. I've been here since January 2016 officially. I've been in emergency management for 12 years, 2 years prior to that in emergency services with a nonprofit agency. I am a graduate of U of M with a bachelor's degree in human resources. I do come into this position from more of a management business perspective, project management perspective, and managing of resources, people and things, than from first responder background. I'm originally from the Oakland County area, Flint area, and then I moved up here to the Midland area and in spring of 2016 after accepting this role here in Midland.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Tell us, I know this has been a very strange year. I can only imagine a very stressful year for you based on the discussion we're about to have. Can you set a baseline, you know, if we're not actively responding to a flood, if we're not actively working within a pandemic, what does your job entail?
So generally from day to day, month to month, year to year, my general jobs are planning for large scale emergencies, preparing for them, writing plans, policy procedures, collaborating with agencies across community, a lot of public safety agencies, police, fire, all of them, and then just being prepared for them and then exercising our plans, testing our plans to see how they work. And then also working with other community partners on response and relief efforts and recovery, those types of things. With their flooding event in 2017, a lot of time since then has been focused on recovery and what we did well and what we didn't do and what we need to prove from not only the Emergency Operations Center and emergency management response perspective, but also from other community partners that became part of the team for those types of situations, was really set up for success for what we experienced in 2020 with the flooding event and dam failure. So day to day, I'm working with a lot of government officials, a lot of other government agencies on those types of big things. In 2020, I was actually hoping to wrap up. We'd already started working on a dam failure response plan with our public safety agencies, identifying impacts and hazards. We had done some exercising in 2019 with Boyce Hydro on a dam failure scenario to really understand roles and responsibilities of different agencies involved, as well as, you know, timing of what may be expected of us and those types of things too. And because of the impact of that type of scenario in our community, we were working on a plan because of the 7 different communities that are involved. There's a huge amount of coordination with that. We have limited resources here for evacuations and things. So we're kind of working through those things. And a lot of it was about how we were going to organize, who was going to make what decisions, and how we were going to work together. Because you can't have one township doing something different than another township, those types of things. So And that's part of my position here as the term coordinator, is to coordinate and bring everybody together, make sure we're all working together and working the smartest we can to provide, you know, information to the community and to respond to the community to protect lives. We also, with 2020, we were working with the schools a lot on planning and stuff, and we were going to be doing some big exercises with the schools on safety drills and those types of things. So we're looking forward to that. So there's a lot of things in 2020. I kind of felt like we were getting past the 2017 flooding event. The recovery had kind of ended, you know, late 2018. There were some big plans that were updated in 2018, 2019 at the county here. So I felt like I was taking a sigh of relief and moving on to some of the projects I wanted to start 3 or 4 years ago here that were kind of sidelined because of flooding and other events. So as 2020 started to roll out in February and stuff, we started hearing information on the news and that kind of stuff about the COVID and what was going on, you know, around the globe and those types of things. The state started providing information. One of the things I'm responsible about dealing with is being engaged with the state of Michigan's Emergency Management, Homeland Security Division. That's where they handle emergency preparedness and response and those types of things and support local and county programs. Also working with our health department. The way that it kind of started was, and kind of has continued, has been very challenging information-wise. Our governor, the way that she decided to run things was very challenging and frustrating and made a lot of decisions. And a lot of times those decisions and information were shared with us as public health professionals and officials and emergency management professional officials. At the same time, they were shared with the public. So we didn't get a lot of heads up on a lot of things. Especially the stay at home and those types of things. So we were reacting and responding the same time, you know, the general public was getting information. And that was very challenging because we weren't able to put anything together to handle phone calls and questions because we didn't have a lot of answers at that time either. I can't really remember exactly when it all started here, but I do know March 13th, that is when I became fully 100% of my time. I actually picked up my office and went over and sat in the office of the health department to support them. Usually what happens is in emergency management, depending on what type of scenario it is, police or fire usually are the lead agencies depending on the hazard. And then emergency management supports them with all these other subject matter experts, whether it's the health department, you know, with hazardous materials, or if it's with sheltering housing with Human Services and Red Cross. It really depends on the incident and how it's affecting our community. It depends on what partners come together to help with that. Well, in this situation, the health department was kind of the incident commander or kind of the front of things, and we were trying to support them, which is something we haven't done in a long time since H1N1. And since then, we've had a lot of turnover in people and that kind of stuff. And this here is very different than H1N1 too, because of its how contagious it is and that type of stuff. So we had a lot of plans in place, and we adapted those plans as much as we could, but because of this type of situation, they weren't as usable as we had hoped they would be. So it was very different. So different type of situation. So I really started from that day forward working to help them with communications, making sure they did really well with talking with, you know, the medical area field, you know, the providers of the health department, the Department of Health and Human Services of the state. But I was kind of liaison for first responders, essential workers, you know, government agencies, the city, the townships and that kind of stuff, and well as the rest of the public and stuff as far as trying to get information out to them. But it was very frustrating because we were reacting at the same time we're trying to provide information, and it's almost like the cart and the horse kept changing around because it was changing quickly. One of my responsibilities, not only in supporting the health department, is the personal protective equipment that was needed for emergency responders and others. So while I'm trying to support them, I'm also trying to figure out what we need, how much we need, and then where can we get it? there was a process to get things through the state, but it was taking a long time. So we were trying to find resources on our own. And that was really difficult. And also because the normal resources that you do normally have were taken up by FEMA and other states and different things, it made it very difficult. So then, and then you also had, you know, companies popping up with stuff that wasn't necessarily standardized and that kind of stuff. So it was very challenging to really try to find something and know what you're getting and hoping that whenever you received it, it was what you ordered and it really provide the protection you were hoping for. I think it took 5 weeks for us to receive any resources from the state regarding personal protection equipment. So that made things, so those agencies that had stuff on hand really had to reuse stuff. They had to try to sterilize stuff. They really had to extend the life of those supplies to get them through until we were able to get more supplies. So that was very challenging. And I became like the PPE coordinator for a lot of agencies. The state developed processes to document what we needed, and then they would almost weekly change how we were supposed to enter information into these different databases to do this. And then they started just pushing stuff to us regardless of what we asked for. And it was just a very challenging time for all of that in trying to control that and manage that, plus also communicate to other partners, you know, this is what we have, not really be able to anticipate when we'd be getting something or what it would be. So we just work with different agencies that, you know, what you have, just try to make it last as long as you can and work from there. The county took on kind of the purchasing and coordination of PPE for all the different fire departments and even law enforcement across the county. Because a lot of, in the very beginning, in order to order quantities, there are huge quantities, like thousands, like 10,000. Well, you know, Drome Township doesn't need 10,000 masks. So we took on those because of the minimum order quantities that were required for those things. And then we were supporting all those different agencies. We also were able to get, you know, homemade masks and that kind of stuff through different community partners and stuff to help pass out and make available to different things, different agencies and organizations and stuff. So, and then also working with the county administration and our essential services, we have a continuity of operations plan for government services. So working on identifying essential staff, what we can and can't do as far as services. So all of those types of things I was involved in with, as well as the health department. I'm providing input and guidance and recommendations and those types of things. So it was really busy. I was working probably 60 hours or so a week. A couple weekends I worked to help support our community. Plus, you know, and then when, you know, we did the stay at home schools and things shut down, I have an elementary age child at home. So that made things interesting. I worked from home for like a couple weeks straight, but once we started receiving PPE and shipments and that kind of stuff, we started having an inventory of that and then distribute it and then track all that stuff. So we bounced between my office and home as much as possible. My daughter's 8. So an 8-year-old sitting in a conference room for 40 plus hours a week is not the most best environment. And they weren't even doing remote schooling at this time. There was just no schooling or a lot of instruction. I think it was maybe like an hour or so a day or something. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't really a lot because again, schools were just kind of trying to figure this out week to week too, and wasn't sure how long stuff was going to extend for. So, but with my job, I always have different options for childcare and stuff, and friends and family can take her. But with COVID, you know, we really rely on our grandparents a lot, and they, you know, obviously being a vulnerable age and population for this, weren't able to take her. So I guess part of a blessing was my husband's job wasn't as essential as mine. So he was able to get laid off during this time. I think he was off for 4 or 5 weeks. So that really helped with her because then I could focus on what I needed to do here for work. Some of the, I guess, big items in which during that time was keeping up with information on positivity, COVID positivity rates in our community. Thankfully, we were pretty slow for our positivity rates to grow. we were a couple of weeks behind more urban communities, and when we didn't really get a huge bloom, you know, it was a little bit trickled at a time. One of the big things I remember is the coordination between the health department, the hospital, and myself and our public information officers when we did have our first death. So making sure that we were all together on that information and who would release that information first and how it would go, you know, be coordinated because of the different agencies involved. And we want to be transparent and all on the same page. So we had, after we had a couple more deaths from it, it wasn't quite as of a big thing because, you know, we kind of had already broken that seal on that. So it became part of our normal day-to-day reporting on, you know, positive cases and those types of things. Just for trying to provide a lot of information from the state to just community partners and things. I'm kind of a one person office, so I'm here by myself. So me, you know, I'm not working in an office with 15, 20 other people. According to the county's continuity of operations plan, emergency services, emergency management is the top, because usually if we have something large scale, we have emergency services, you know, is active doing something. So I'm kind of the first person to support, and then other county operations become a priority after emergency services. So I never get a day off when things are bad. So I was essential. So I actually got to work extra time during all of this and just kind of support our health department as much as possible. Any way we can, and provide information to the community the best way we can. So that was kind of in the middle of March, things started. In mid-April, things seemed to be calming down. We started getting personal protective equipment in, started distributing it, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Our biggest challenge was, how long was this going to last? You know, how busy was, you know, emergency services going to be? Thankfully, you know, calls for medical calls and hospital and stuff, those really went down, which means that we didn't have to use as much PPE that we normally would have, because people didn't want to go to the hospital. You know, they weren't calling for things that they might have done before because of the situation. So it all kind of evened out a little bit, but it was very hard to project that kind of stuff and then figure out how much you need per shift and per call and those types of things. And just keeping open communication between the health department and, you know, we have a county dispatch here. I mean, they're 24/7 for calls, and they're people too, and they have families too. And so all of those types of things, working through all of those challenges and hoops and different things to be able to provide services, but also keep people safe. So there's a lot going on. There was a couple, some of the offices here at the law enforcement center went to kind of like lockdown, where very few people came and went. There was a time just within dispatch where they completely closed to everybody. No one was able to come in and out, you know, those types of things, just so that they could reduce exposure because of limited staffing capabilities. And you have to have a few people working together at one time. You can't, you know, people can't be there by themselves, and it's not a remote from home, work from home type of situation at all. So keeping those folks safe as much as possible and keeping them from getting ill, you know, was a priority there, and respecting all of the different decisions that different organizations were making during this. So we learned a lot. I think it really built a lot of relationships. There's always been pretty good communication, especially in the emergency management between the city and the county, with planning and that kind of thing. So getting information out to people wasn't an issue. It was getting the information to provide out and trying to provide information ahead of time was a huge challenge. So it was really hard to prepare and tell people what to expect in the next week and that kind of stuff, because things kept changing. And again, we weren't really getting a lot of information prior to a press conference. So that was the biggest challenge. Things seemed to be slowing down, you know, end of April or so. I remember I was working from home prior to May 18th, the weekend leading up to the flooding event and dam failure. You know, we had some communications with National Weather Service, and I wasn't really getting information to show to say that we were really concerned about some things. We're getting a couple inches of rain. We weren't expecting to have flooding in our first forecast. You know, it was actually like very minimum flooding here. So I remember coming in the 18th that morning into my office. Within an hour, I just picked up my little work area and I went over to our emergency operations center to just be there so I could just focus on nothing but keeping up with information that was coming in. Lots of communications with Gladwin County because they were experiencing a lot of flooding Sunday night. They did some evacuations, those types of things. And everything comes this way, right? But in the past, they've had flooding up there and some evacuations around the dams without it really impacting us a lot. So, and even going back to like the exercising we did with Boys Hydro, you know, year beforehand, even in those scenarios, there's not a clear black and white that if this happens and this will happen as far as cascading impacts with flooding at the dams or failures or issues at the dams upstream from Edenville and then through Sanford. So we're working in a lot of gray area. I also started good conversation communication with National Weather Service, just keeping looped in with them. If they needed to update the forecast or the flooding forecast for the river and stuff, they always gave me a call so I wouldn't just have to look for it or come across it. But Monday, you know, we started having virtual briefings with our staff, city partners and stuff regarding flooding. You know, we have flooding a lot here in Midland, so we have kind of groups that we've created to provide information to already. As it got bigger, we started expanding those groups. It's interesting because they always say in emergency management, disasters never happen Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. We had a briefing Monday morning, and then we had another one at 4 o'clock or 5. We had a briefing again that, hey, this is where we're at. You know, we're just expecting to have, you know, some minor flooding here in the city, those types of things. And then somewhere between 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock and on, it just went kind of sideways or off the train tracks with different things. Information just kept coming in about flooding. We got updated forecast with the National Weather Service on flooding. We went from like 25 to 26 feet of crust to, I think we're looking at 28 feet of crust. We also around 7 or 8 o'clock started receiving significant spills from the dams. They report to us whenever they spill. That's just part of their normal policies. I get called all times of the night when they start increasing spills during heavy rainfall events and that kind of stuff. So they were letting me know that this is what they're spilling so that we can, you know, pass that along to National Weather Service and that kind of stuff to have a better understanding of what our impacts or flooding will be. Usually we crest here about 24 hours after it stops raining. So we have time, you know, to get information out and then do evacuations like we have to. But all of a sudden, you know, the dams went from spilling, you know, I guess a lot to all, like completely open their gates, which that is a lot of water for us. And during 17, they were spilling at maximum capacity. So yes, that is still a flooding concern, but we weren't thinking dam failure at that time. About, I think around 9 o'clock that night or so, things were getting updated. Our flood forecast was being updated by National Weather Service. Hearing a lot more information from Gladwin on Wixom Lake up there and the flooding they were experiencing up there. A lot of just information coming in. I checked with the dam owner. I always check in and just say, hey, just checking in. Where are you guys at? You know, I'm aware that you guys have increased the spill, those types of things. And I've been doing this, you know, for 4 or 5 years. I have a good relationship with the dam operators. I usually can ask them, okay, what do you think we're going to be looking at the next 6, 12, 18 hours? And they would be able to tell me, well, this is what we think, you know, in the next hour or two, we're going to, you know, kind of hit our high point and then we're going to start going down. We're already seeing, you know, lower water levels in these areas. And then that obviously slowly impacts downstream. And the phone call I had that night, with a dam operator, for the first time, he was not able to tell me what he was anticipating for the next 6 or 12 hours. And if you go back to 2017, we had flash flooding overnight, and we had people woken up in early hours of the morning by flooding, waters in their homes, rivers overflown in darkness. Because of that experience, that brought me a lot of concerns that between now and morning, potentially what might happen, worst case scenario, and how that would impact our community from a safety standpoint. And with that and my concerns, we scheduled a briefing. I was able to get everybody together. I think we had probably 100 people on the call, 60 to 100 people on the call at 11 o'clock that night. And I made the recommendation to do evacuations for those communities directly downstream from the dam. The dams are required to have emergency action plans and provide information to us. So with working with them, I'm familiar with their plans. Also, and there is an analysis of impacts and the timing of impacts. So we knew that if there was a breach or failure at Edenville, within an hour or so, this is where the water would be and rising potentially this level. And the Sanford area is within that 1 to 5 hour time frame. And that's not a lot of time in the middle of the night to evacuate people, especially if you don't know how infrastructure, roads, and bridges are being impacted as that water comes down and rises. And I did not want to put our residents in a situation like that. I would rather do it timely and safely before and when we had time to evacuate.
And part of the reason. I want to personally say thank you here. And I actually have screenshots. I was sitting in my basement with my kids. We had a home theater set up down there, and I have screenshots. 7:36 Tuesday, May 19th, we got that evacuation order, and we were able to get everything packed, everybody safely out, and to relatives across town.
Yeah.
So I can say how important that was.
Yeah, so there's limitations with emergency warning, especially in our community that's very rural in this area. Sometimes spotty cell phone coverage. If you don't have your cell phone on, you don't get the alert. You know, people in, you know, disable alerts. Not everybody is signed up with Nixle through the County Central Dispatch. And this is something we really wanted everybody to hear the message. So we use the same similar platform that the Weather Service does to issue tornado warnings and that kind of stuff. But you'd never know if everybody received those warnings. So we felt that being that we had time, the dam wasn't failing, things were looking not favorable for us, and we didn't know how much time before we may be looking at a worst case scenario, we had time to do door-to-door evacuations. And being that there's a lot of retired people in this area and that kind of stuff, I felt that was important. And I think that's what led to our success here, is they got the alert. Most people got the alert on their phones and that kind of stuff that we were evacuating. And then they were followed up by a knock on the door by the sheriff's department or the fire department that explained the situation and let them know where they could go for sheltering. And I think that was huge to do that, because it's one thing to get alert on your phone and be in the middle of sleep and just go back to sleep and then not even be aware. Or it's another one to get alert and be like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. I've never seen that before. It must be an error, you know, and not, you know, pay attention to it. It's another thing to have someone actually physically knock on your door and say, we're very concerned and we're asking people to evacuate because of our level of concern. But if we wouldn't have done that, if we would have waited until things deteriorated further on at the dam, we probably wouldn't have had that opportunity, or we wouldn't have been able to be as successful with that opportunity because we wouldn't have had the resources at the right time for that. So that was really critical in that decision-making. We're a rural area outside the city. All of our fire departments are on call, paid firefighters. And most of them work. They all work full time. They have jobs. They have responsibilities. Those types of things. You know, the jobs that pay the bills. So 11 o'clock at night during the week is probably when we have 95% of our resources available, personnel wise, to actually conduct this type of operation. All our public safety partners all agreed with me and supported me, and we implemented it. Because we had been working on a plan, a response plan for the last year or two, each of those jurisdictions had already looked at every street, every home, and address that may be impacted or that they would have to potentially close due to flooding and impacts from a dam failure. So they already had a list of every address that they needed to evacuate, and they had already put it kind of in groups so that they could assign resources to go down and leapfrog and whatever they needed to do to get to every one of those doors to make that notification. Because of all that planning and having that already, they were able to just implement that, rip out pages from the plan, maps, and assign duties and go. So, which was a very good time for us.
Can I ask, so this was countywide, correct? Because obviously, you know, we in the city of Midland were greatly affected. Samford was much more greatly affected. So this was, this operation to knock on doors, this was countywide?
Yeah, so
wow,
all the fire departments across the county stood up and went to assist Edenville and Jerome. Homer came up, Midland came up, the city of Midland came up to assist, because you can do more with 40 firefighters than you can do with 10 firefighters. And then you also have to remember these people live in these communities, so their families may have needed to be evacuated too. And that does affect situations. We also had to do some evacuations in Hope Township because of the flooding stuff that was happening there closer to the Wixom Lake. Hope Township actually goes up close around the dam and a little bit north of the dam on the one end.
Okay.
So, and that's a lot of work, right? Go door to door. I think it was like 400 homes in Edenville Township that had to be doors knocked on, about 500 or 700 in Jerome Township, which included the village of Sanford. So we're talking roughly 1,000 doors to knock on. So, and it took them about 3 to 4 hours to commit to do that. So when you're looking at a plan and you see that given a failure and you have an hour to do something, and it just took you 3 hours to do what you needed to do in 15 minutes, that's important with preparedness and planning.
Absolutely. That's a wild thought. And can I ask, injuries and fatalities associated with the flood?
To this date, we are not aware of any fatalities with the flood. And I think we heard of one injury, someone that tripped on their stairs, you know, during the evacuation or whatever, but nothing life-threatening, nothing major, no major car accidents, no one being swept away with water, anything like that. Everything was able to be done timely and smoothly. I think, you know, people obviously were maybe a little panicked and stuff, but since the dam hadn't actually failed, it was a lot lower level of panic because they had time. This was a cautionary measure at this time. It wasn't, you know, it's happened, get out of the way type of thing. And I think that really helps people in the community to evacuate because it's a little bit lower stress level than just thinking, because I think a lot of people think when a dam fails, they just think of like a tsunami, like a wall of water. And that's not really happens. I mean, water comes down, but it goes, you know, the path of least resistance, which is the normal river and lake. And then it comes up. You know, the height of the water comes up, and there are certain areas on Sanford Lake where we're looking at maybe a 12-foot rise in the lake because of the water. So that's significant, but that's not stuff that you can communicate with people, you know, during this. You just need to let them know these are our concerns and we're asking you to evacuate, and these are your shelters that you can go to. And our schools are amazing for us to pull this off like we did. Red Cross, it takes them a while. Red Cross had a lot of limitations with the pandemic. A lot of their volunteers and stuff are vulnerable populations, so they really didn't have the capacity and resources to respond right away to open up a shelter here in Midland. So our schools came in, our school personnel came in, opened the doors and just did whatever they could to receive people, provide food, we got donations, those types of things. They really acted in a capacity that they never had to do and they've never been trained to do. And through all of that, and not to have any transfer of COVID in any of our shelters or anything like that is super amazing. Even now to this day with all the volunteers and stuff that we've had come in community and different things, we haven't had any reports of COVID transmission within those groups and in those people because of the precautions we've taken. We did have people in our community that were being monitored because of COVID during this time. So our health department immediately reached out to them and made sure that those that were in the evacuation areas were given a place to stay away from the larger population. So those are some things that we had to kind of do on the fly that we wouldn't have normally thought of. But we did make sure that those things were taken care of and we were able to get them into a hotel or something like that right away in order to provide them safe shelter, but also to protect the rest of the community that would be at the shelter. And those are some plans that we had ahead of time, just what our plan was and what actually had to happen ended up being a little bit different given the scenario and situation.
Wonderful. And just for archival knowledge sake, the schools that opened up, Midland High and Komen High, I know of. Were there others?
So, Monday night, it was Meridian Junior High that opened up and Komen, I think, Junior High that opened up. Those two schools opened up because they were in the north part of that area and it was easy for people east and west of the river to go to those locations because they were familiar with those locations. We really didn't want people crossing the river or that kind of thing. We really wanted to make sure that we had resources that were accessible on either side of the river and lake.
Certainly.
And with the pandemic, the schools were closed. So if the schools weren't closed, we didn't have a pandemic, it would have been a lot harder because they're required to have school, right? So mm-hmm. I think depending on the situation, it might have been difficult for our schools to be willing to close school the next day in order to open as a shelter, because you can't have a shelter and school going on. So there are some things about the pandemic that were pros for this situation and made things easier. And there are obviously, you know, a lot of things that it made a lot more challenging, past a lot more challenging.
Certainly, absolutely. So I think that's an amazing recount of the flood itself. What did and knowing obviously your involvement with the FEMA process after the disaster was announced, and I imagine leading up to it, what did your day after the floods? So May 21st, I got back into my home after the flood. What are your days starting to look like now that the water is going down?
Well, I was kind of talking about Monday night, the 18th, but the dam didn't actually fail until the next day on the 19th.
Yeah.
I will never forget getting that phone call, having that phone call, and our immediate actions after that. Our ability to get warning out was amazing, really fast with that. Our dispatch center did awesome, kind of off the fly, as far as giving directions, as far as evacuations for the community. If you live east or west of this, that was a lot done on the fly because we hadn't really got to that part of the plan, our draft plan. We were really focusing on evacuations and those types of things in command and control. We didn't really get to the rest of it. So receiving that call and then me calling the National Weather Service was my first call after that to let them know. We had worked with them on some additional warning capabilities. They were able to issue a flash flood warning for the Tiwassee River for us. So a lot of people got more than one warning or alert on their phone about the dam failure. They got one from us, and then they got one from the National Weather Service for that area. So that really helped. Also, I got to call our neighbors in Saginaw and let them know that, hey, this has happened, because they are downstream of us in the inundation area went 5 miles into Saginaw County for the dam failure. So
really,
so they would have some impacts as well. We also then activated the Emergency Operations Center. That's basically a big room where we all come together. We have screens to display information. We work together as a group to share information and make sure we're all going forward in the same lane. That's where we coordinate shelters, those types of things.
Can I ask right there with the Emergency Coordination Center, and can you take me to this room and maybe give me some people, some names of folks who were working and positions working together in this room with you on this emergency?
Absolutely. So some of the responsible roles and stuff in the Emergency Operations Center at the county level are Board of Commissioners, the chairman of the Board of Commissioners, Mark Bone at this present time. He has the authority to declare a disaster for Midland County. Brad Kay is the city manager, has authority to declare a local state disaster for the city of Midland. We also have a representative from State Emergency Management Division that came in there. He helps with the coordination of information from the county to the state, requesting a governor's declaration. We got a governor's declaration, I believe, within a couple hours after the dam failed, which is amazing. Wow. They really understood how catastrophic this event was in the state and to our community. We got a lot of support from the National Guard to come up to help with things for the emergency response of it. And also we were able to keep them on for welfare checks and that kind of stuff like the day or so after. We have DPW, we have Road Commission, we have City DPW in there, Karen Murphy, Art Buck from Road Commission comes in. We have John Sarles from the Education Service Agency, ESA. He represents the schools. So his role is to get information and provide it to the other schools. He's like the liaison. We have human services in here. We have people from Department of Health and Human Services come in. They work with Red Cross on those things. Bridget Granston, she's not only our administrator controller, so she does kind of the approving the finances because these things aren't not necessarily free and cheap. She also is part of our public information team. So she comes in, Selena Tisdale from the city and Katie Geyer, City Communications, they come in. They are a phenomenal team that work together to support each other. At one point, we had all three of them in the EOC all working on different informational pieces to get out to the community. And then also, like we had talked about earlier, we're in a pandemic. They have kids, they have families. Some of them were working from home, some of them weren't. So they, have to make, try to figure out a schedule between the two or three of them, find out what they're going to do with their young children, those types of things. So there's a lot of challenges that these people, not only because of the responsibility they have, but also they have personal lives too. And these things happen 24/7. So they have to have those things in place and to prepare. And we're very flexible. We had a lot of people come together, but because of how big this was and how much going on, we physically had to have people in the room talking. We could not have done this virtually. When you have 30 or 40 people that you're trying to coordinate and they're trying to do all their different pieces to do that virtually, I wouldn't be able to do that. Even today with understanding Zoom and different things and groups and stuff like that, rooms, I don't think I would have been able to do that. After the dam failed and the next day and stuff, and we started getting a more better handle on things, we did limit who was in the Emergency Operations Center, and we started doing virtual briefings twice a day with community partners. But we had a good core group of 20 or so people, maybe 30 people that worked in the EOC. We also had others come in. Army Corps of Engineers came in. They started out with like a team of two or three, and they ended up at one point having 12 people here that we set them up in another room to help support their operations with inspections of the dam, those types of things. Planning, giving us information on the current situation of the dams, what we could expect with potential rain events, all of those things, because all that stuff has changed. So they provide us a lot of technical information, also work with the state, that kind of thing. So just a lot of community partners and agencies that have responsibilities in certain areas of the community come together for this. We have the police department here, We have the Sheriff's Department representative. We have EMS representative. So just a large group of folks that come together to make decisions, because a lot of these decisions don't always fall within policy or procedures. We have to make a decision based on what we know and then how best do we handle it. Excuse me.
Sure.
So, and because we had a plan together for that first few hours or so, I guess you could say, we didn't have to like create that operation and stuff in the EOC. And when the dam failed, everybody knew their role and they just implemented all their parts and pieces and just reported in with updates. So we knew exactly what everybody was doing because they were following their parts of the plan. So that was huge to have that. And our fire departments were really good neighboring departments helping each other out. So, and again, it was after five or so, so there was a lot of people home from work. So there was a lot of resources kind of available too. So the next day after that kind of gets blurry. We did have a special team because this was going to be a long-term event. A lot of different things going on with donations and relief efforts and volunteers and information community stuff. We did have a specialized team come in to help us kind of get reorganized a little bit, staff some positions. Because again, outside the city, a lot of people, they work full-time and they do fire and even some elected officials, supervisors and treasurers and clerks and stuff for the townships, they work full-time and they do that on a part-time, somewhat volunteer basis. So we really had limited resources, 8 to 5. And our emergency operations center ran 12 hours, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. for a good next 2 weeks, 7 days a week to handle all the stuff and coordinate it and make sure that we were being able to support whatever needed to go on in the local communities and make sure that we're doing the same thing across all the communities.
Wow, that's amazing. And it is a note. When you think about outside of Midland County, just as a historical note, when you think about outside of Midland County, the only other city in Midland County is Coleman, and they have about 1,200 people. So how rural it is surrounding this, and that emergency resource center had to service all of it, not just the city.
And the city fire did a great job reaching out to neighboring communities. We had people from all over the place, Huron County, as far as Huron County sheriff's departments and fire personnel that come in with boats and different types of equipment, some specialized equipment, because we really anticipated a lot of water rescue operations. And then we also, you know, it's one thing to think about a dam failure and see what might happen. But again, just like the 100-year floodplain, this inundation area, that's an educated guess. You know, so until you actually experience it, do you really understand sometimes the impacts? Because you're not really sure how, you have an idea, you have a blob of where the water is, but you don't really know understand the depths of the water and those types of things, because we just didn't have that information into that detail format. So we had a good idea of how widespread it would be, but until you actually experience it. And then the biggest factor is people, you know. In 17, we did a lot of evacuations and people didn't leave. And then like a half hour later, they couldn't leave because of the flooding. So then they wanted to be evacuated. So we weren't sure if we were going to be in that situation again. So you have to, you know, kind of prepare for all these, and you still get, again, have the same number of people. So we were able to bring other people in to really help us. And a lot of them we didn't end up using, which is great. But having that support and all those resources there available if we need them is fantastic. And a lot of that was free. They just wanted to come and help. They said, this is what we are able to do. This is the number of people we have. This is the equipment we have. And they just came. So that's amazing. And that was a lot for City Fire to coordinate and respond. And then if any of the townships needed additional resources, they were able to assign those resources throughout the county. It wasn't just city. But obviously the city has a huge dam failure footprint as well. So a lot of things happen behind the scenes that a lot of people aren't aware of. Even with the wastewater services in the city, them providing the maps of their pump stations and that kind of stuff, that was some of the stuff that we we kind of prepared when we were talking about the planning and stuff. Okay, how does this scenario impact your operations and those types of things? And so for them to be able to have that information ready or together to provide to people timely is huge, because when we're flooding, they're busy. They're busy doing things. They're busy attending pumps or shutting down pumps or whatever, trying to save infrastructure so that we don't end up without pumps. And in some of the conversations we had, depending on how some of this infrastructure was impacted, we were looking at possibly not having water and waste services for maybe a month in the city if things were really bad. So considering what happened and how they handle things and that these services were back up and running within a day or two is unbelievable. Unbelievable. The people that work in this community for public services and stuff, they are really here to make a positive impact in the community and to really serve the residents. And I think some people forget that sometimes. They just see their water bill and they're like, ah, you know, but there's a lot that goes on behind that. And it's infrastructure and all this stuff. It's not a cheap thing, you know, it really isn't. And there's a lot that goes into it. So again, amazing team, amazing people to really work with through all of this. And, you know, you have all these townships in the city and the county folks that all come together. And there's, when situations come up or issues or challenges, there's never a, that's not my role responsibility or that's not my job. It's always, I have this. How can I help? What can we do? And that's fantastic. That's awesome, because really it's about how we all come together to do this, regardless of where it is, because it's the county as a whole.
That's awesome. It's an amazing sense of community here. Personally being affected by the flood, I can tell you that comes down to the neighbor level. You know, okay, my basement's pumped out. Let's move that pump over to your basement. That kind of thing is just, it's great to see. It says quite a bit about our community.
Yeah, neighbors helping neighbors. And that's where it comes down to personal preparedness or even community preparedness, is people, you know, they prepare the best they can for themselves. Everybody should be prepared to evacuate their home at a moment's notice, and everybody should be prepared to have to shelter in their home at a moment's notice. We live in a community that has not only flooding that may cause evacuations, but we also have some significant chemical facilities that we may have to shelter in your home for a extended period of time until, you know, we know it's safe for you to come out. And you might have to make sure that you seal up your home, whether it's just making sure the windows and doors are closed or if it's, you know, something more than that. And people really need to be aware of the hazards around them in their community. Midland's a beautiful place, but there's still hazards in their community. Our biggest vulnerability is weather, rain. I mean, you can't stop it from raining, but hopefully with forecasting and timing information, we can best inform people and prepare people for things. Unfortunately, our last two big rain events, we're only supposed to get an inch or two of rain, and we end up getting 5 to 8 inches of rain, which is sometimes frustrating. But I think we've done a really good job with informing people as best as we can. The county, also one of the projects that I'm responsible for, Midland County has a hazard mitigation plan, and that is available for public to view. We actually, every time we update the plan and seek approval from FEMA and the state, we have public hearings on it, and it has in there our flooding hazards. It has in there the dam failures, the impacts, the mapping. It has severe weather information there. All that information is in there and available to the public. So I really encourage residents to seek out that kind of information so that they can be better prepared based on where they're located within the county.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wonderful note. So let's talk about the summer. What was going on? I imagine there was still a lot of these groups working into the summer as we moved. You know, the water's gone. That doesn't mean the emergency's gone.
Right. When people returned to their homes, it was very devastating. We lost a lot of homes. Like, they just went down the river. So it was very devastating for a lot of our folks. And there's a process that we do that's called damage assessment, where we assess the level of damage across our community, not only municipal impacts, but also residential impacts, private impacts, those types of things. And if you remember, there was a survey kind of sent out for people to report their information. And by people reporting that information, it helps us build the information we need to request a federal declaration, which provides FEMA resources to us, federal resources to us, not only to the municipality, if we get a public assistance, but also to residents, which is SBA and FEMA loans and those types of things, or FEMA grants. And that's a huge part of the process. And I know sometimes it's frustrating for people to submit all their information, but without that, we can't advocate for them, and we can't advocate for their neighbors and their community that this is how this has changed our community and the challenges that we have now and going forward in this community, and how much of a financial burden it is, as well as other burdens on our community for this. This time with the request to the president for relief was probably one of the more frustrating processes I've been through. I've been through the process before, but there are certain thresholds that as a community we have to meet for level of damage, and at the state level that we need to meet for level of damage before FEMA would recommend federal programs being made available to us. And number wise, we met all of those things. It was basically up to FEMA recommended the presidential disaster declaration for both individual assistance and public assistance. Unfortunately, because of the pandemic that was going on and a lot of resources already being taken up because of the pandemic, and then I think some of the politics between our governor and the president, that didn't lay a very good solid foundation for a smooth coordination, I think, between the two of them regarding this. And thankfully, Congressman Molinar kind of took on that challenge and barrier for us, and met with the president. And I think through that connection and that conversation and things, that really helped secure a presidential declaration for us. That's something that I would have expected to happen within a week or two, for it taking almost 30 days for that to happen. Very, very frustrating. That really impacted our sheltering of people, our residents, and municipal organizations' ability to recover, because locally we don't have money for people. Thankfully, in our community, through the foundations and the flood relief funds and stuff they established, that helps, but there's a criteria for that, and we have to use that money to try to meet the most needs too. And that's not always immediate. And that's very stressful for people, because they see the immediate need. But the only really money that's eligible is federal money. But if you don't get the signature of the president, then that doesn't happen. And then with COVID and stuff, FEMA's response here was delayed. They usually are out in our community, meeting with people, helping people. Because of COVID, they didn't do that. They tried to do everything over the phone or through an app and virtually, which it sounds like a lot of our residents were very successful with that in the very beginning weeks and stuff. But, you know, an elderly person or someone that's not as tech savvy, and I myself am a people person, I like to be able to call or talk to someone. I hate filling out forms online, especially if all you have is a smartphone, you know, a small device to try to do that. It can be very aggravating. And then they set up a document drop-off center, which, you know, our feedback to them was kind of maybe not call it that, maybe call it the coordination center, because people could go there and start the application there. They didn't have to have their application completed or anything like that. So we didn't get a lot of traffic there because it was pretty slow. So COVID really challenged a lot of that. I'm hoping that everybody that tried to get assistance through FEMA were able to get in through the deadline and get that process started and that kind of stuff. Another thing that kind of came up because of the dam failure and the water table and stuff, a lot of people had very shallow wells up in Edenville and even north into Gladwin. And by that water lowering in the reservoir and emptying a lot of those creeks and stuff, those wells were impacted. So people whose homes were impacted by flooding now didn't have water. And it's hard to live in a house without water. So Gladwin has a huge amount of issues with that. And as we continue to stabilize the dam and make changes up there, they might continue to have those issues. That is something that FEMA normally does not consider eligible expense. But because of our situation here and how unique it was, and us really bringing all the experts together to talk it over, we're able to get FEMA to make that eligibility. In fact, they actually made a special application process and extended it just for people with well issues to help with that, so that those folks weren't, put to do, figure out a well on their own, especially because of the instability and unknown in that area still. People could redrill a well and then a month later lose water again because it's still changing. And so working with FEMA through that really, really was a positive out of FEMA. I think there's been over $17 million through individual assistance made available to residents in Midland County. That's a huge number. That's a recovery that we wouldn't be able to do as a community. There's been, I think, over $1 million in rental assistance, just helping people with temporary housing until they could get back into their homes and stuff. SBA has, reports of similar numbers, $15 million in loans and that kind of stuff to all help people. Again, the government's here to help you. They're not an insurance agency. They're not going to make you whole. They're here to help you because it's really on the homeowner to be aware of potential hazards, just like you have homeowners insurance, your house don't build, burn down and those types of things, because those things can happen. Flood insurance the same way. So it's really as a homeowner responsibility for some things. And that's frustrating with a lot of homeowners, especially given the dam failure situation, because a lot of people that were drastically impacted did not have flood insurance because they were not in the flood area. And part of our flood response plan was going to be doing a large hazard community information of getting information out to folks in that area to let them know that in the event that this happens, you're going to be impacted, and recommend different things that they should be doing and how they should get notified and stuff. And we unfortunately just didn't get that far in our process. But also, the challenges with Boyce Hydro and the dams and lowering of the reservoirs and different things and the FERC issue and then all of that, a lot of that was writing on the wall that there's a lot of issues going on there too. And that's why, Gladwin and Midland County started the process a couple of years ago to try to own those dams and try to prevent what happening. Obviously, no one really thought the dam was going to fail. Even those people that were standing on the dam when it breached, they were not really anticipating it was failed. Some of the signs that they normally see for a dam failure were not showing structurally at the dam. So even the experts that I rely on to tell me what's going to be happening soon, they were very surprised that the dam breached when it did, how it did. And so I don't know if that's a maintenance issue or whatever that, or if it's just old infrastructure, or if it was just because there was so much darn water that it caused a lot. Water's heavy. I mean, if you think about a gallon of milk or a gallon of water, think about millions and millions of gallons in the lake all against that structure. That's not designed to stop it from flooding. I mean, that's why you have a plan for dams, because there could be situations where the water is more than what the dam was designed to hold. So it was really, really a challenging time. We really had to make some decisions without a lot of good information. We had to make decisions and recommendation based on what we had at the time. And sometimes it was decisions for worst case. And I'd rather plan for worst case and have best case happen. I think that's what happened with evacuations and everything. So the FEMA process was very frustrating for people, especially if they didn't qualify, because it's based on eligibility. Every family has their own financial situation, those types of things, level of impact, that kind of stuff. That's all closed up, you know, end of October. So it all closed up last fall. Our long-term recovery group is going on strong. We got amazing amount of donations from the community through the flood relief fund. And we've already, as of this week, we've already approved $1.3 million in funding to residents to help them with their recovery efforts with their homes and different things, which is huge. And everybody is having a different level depending on their need. You know, a lot of people were able to take care of some things and they still have some stuff hanging out. We're now seeing the process more complicated types of situations, because a lot of those, you know, easy things to do, drywall and that kind of stuff, people are able to do that. Now we're at the point where people really don't have the skills to do it, or they didn't do it in time. So it's created a bigger issue, those types of things. But the number of agencies that have come together for temporary housing, provide grant money for temporary housing. You know, we had laundry certificates so people could wash their clothes. The community center offered showers up for people to take showers. We had a lot of issues with the Red Cross and sheltering. So the county, working with our convention and visitor bureaus, provided rooms to like almost 50 families that were now hoping to get reimbursement through FEMA for, because of the pandemic and because of their needs. Plus we had a really hot summer, and when people don't have, you know, central air and those types of things, it makes it very hard for a lot of people to live in that environment without those things. So, but we did immediately see that once there was federal assistance made available, those people that we were sheltering stuff then did get the resources they need to move on to more long-term housing and those types of things. So that was critical. But because of the delay, meant that those people were delayed in their recovery efforts because they just didn't have resources available. A lot of people in the Sanford area were renters. So even though they had a home to stay at the time, they were really lenient on the landlord on getting it fixed up and getting them to move back in. And if the landlord had a lot of challenges in doing that, that delayed those people. And then just on a nice normal sunny day in Midland County, housing is difficult. It's challenging, especially low income housing for people that need to rent and those types of things. There's just not a lot of availability in the market. So you add this onto that and it's just a double whammy for us. So, and we were able to kind of communicate that a little bit to FEMA, but FEMA looks at maybe a larger geographical area than what we would for our community. So that provided some of the barriers and challenges we had with some of those types of programs. But today there's a lot going on. I think our construction committee meeting earlier this week, they've got 15 projects going on right now where they're actually in 15 different homes working on stuff through volunteers.
Residential homes?
Yep, residential homes. Yep, all this is residential homes they're working on. They have like another dozen or so that they have on the list to evaluate and determine the potential cost and repairs and those types of things. So again, a lot of work's being done. Right after the flood, usually we get a lot of volunteer organizations that come in with muck outs and all that kind of stuff. And because of COVID, a lot of them weren't deploying. We've had a lot of community partners come in. We've had a lot of out of the box type of relief efforts. I think a lot of the cleanup and stuff that went on in the Sanford area and even Midland were just people that came into the community that said, hey, I'm here to help, and not necessarily trained to help. So we've seen that, you know, a lot of people took out a lot more of their drywall and things that they really needed to, which unfortunately impacts us negatively in the long run. But again, a lot of people just you don't know what you don't know. So that, you know, working with United Way and having those volunteers, we're able to have people that really did those things properly. And then you have obviously a lot of people that just kind of stand up, they want to help, they have the best intentions, but sometimes they create a little bit more of a problem than what we originally had, but that always happens during a disaster. So it's just trying to manage that and police that. It's very challenging. So, you know, 6-9 months away now from the dam failure, there's a lot of recoveries happen. There's still a lot of recovery that needs to happen. The village of Sanford has really changed. And I think over the next 5 or 10 years, you're going to continue to see a lot of change with their housing and that kind of stuff. We have a lot of people working together in leadership roles to advocate for our community, working with others from the state and federal agencies and even DC and stuff to really identify resources, funding, those types of things that we can advocate to bring here to help rebuild our community.
Absolutely fantastic. That's more than I knew about going on. So it's really interesting to hear. And I, you know, I hope people understand the breadth of work happening. Well, I think that's really excellent. Can I ask, just for the sake of knowledge, you know, on February 10th, 2021, has the city, where does the city lie with FEMA funding? Because you mentioned the residential.
So both currently the county and the city are bringing together all their documentation to submit to try to get those costs reimbursed. Some of those costs can be reimbursed at like 75%, some of them at 80%, depending on what types of tasks they were. There's different categories. There's, you know, emergency response. So there's different things with police and fire, you know, those types of actions. And there's different also with general EOC operations, and then ongoing things. So there's different categories. We also, the city had a lot of damages, you know, the library and that kind of stuff. So that's a different category. At the county, you know, our county parks were really impacted, especially in the village of Sanford. We lost our beach, you know, all of that there. We have a lot of trees down and a lot of debris still over there. We're working through FEMA on trying to get that looked at as eligible reimbursement work. I think we're looking at a good $250,000 worth of debris cleanup still in that area. So that's long ongoing because there's inspections that have to be done and documentation and all of that kind of stuff. So the city and county are still going through those things at this time. A lot of lessons learned. I mean, we've always been really good at keeping documentation, but there's actually in this process, there's a lot of documentation that needs to be done before you even have a disaster to show that, you know, this property was even maintained. Like, did you write down every time you mowed it or trim trees and those types of things to show it was a maintained piece of property and it was just not natural habitat? A lot of those different things. So it gets very detailed. It's very, very frustrating sometimes, the amount of detail you have to provide, but we all know there's rules and things are because at one point someone took advantage of things. So they've had to create rules because people may not have been as honest in the past with these types of things. So we're all working through that process. Hopefully we can try to recoup as much as the funding and stuff as we can to cover our expenses that we had. And again, we learned a lot from it. So I have now another new list of to-do things to work on, to put, you know, some new policies and things in place and update some of our procedures, because we learned a lot of things too. I mean, it's sometimes on those really challenging days of paperwork and documentation, I just remember that, you know, we didn't lose any lives. And
absolutely,
have an event like this and not have that is really extraordinary. I've had people from California and Texas and all these other places that have all these big, huge dams and stuff that really are amazed at like what we were able to do here. And in comparison to those communities, we're tiny. And they're just like, you know, because they have all these flashy buttons and all this stuff. So being able to share our story with them and kind of what we did here and our steps and process and stuff has, you know, obviously benefited them as well. And it's been a little bit therapeutic for us here. I mean, all of us, everybody, I think, in the community was impacted by this one way or another. They either knew somebody, they're impacted themselves or through work. I wasn't personally impacted at home by this, but within my position, there was a lot of long days, a lot of very stressful moments, a lot of heavy decisions to make a decision to evacuate, you know, hundreds of homes, to disrupt someone's life, and knowing that these lives are families and people that might have medical conditions or might have behavioral conditions or things that, you know, is really going to be impactful in their life because you have concerns about their safety. Those are big things. You know, that's not choosing what kind of milk you want to get at the grocery store. Those are some big things, and it always heavy on us. And fortunately, we didn't have to have large community funerals for this or any of that type of thing. But we also have a lot of people that, you know, have been traumatized by this. We've been really doing a lot of mental health stuff since the summer. We've done a lot with our first responders and other community partners, and been making those things available since the summer to even residents and stuff. So I remember over the course of the summer, you know, the state would send out the alerts and stuff about wearing masks and different things, you know, the stay home, those things. And I remember seeing stuff on social media about people saying, how many of you just, you know, heart rate increased because that's the alert that you heard when the dams broke, you know, going back to that memory of that and stuff. And I think it'll take a long time for our people to heal from that. And I don't think it's a new thing anybody's ever going to forget. Hopefully others learn from us and know that it can happen. I think the biggest thing is, I think no one really ever expected this to happen. I mean, it's something that hasn't happened really much, you know, across the country and stuff. There's been a few little incidents, but it just shows you that, you know, our infrastructure is expensive and it's getting old and it really needs to be maintained. And so having dollars to do that, whether public, private, is important because of the impacts it has in communities. So our community's been through a lot this last year, you know, between the flooding and the pandemic and stuff. But I think in a lot of ways it's made us stronger and rise above it. And I'm hoping that, you know, it has some lasting positive community impacts on us, you know, neighbors, helping neighbors. I think in some areas of our community, people go home, they close their garage door and they don't talk to their neighbors. And even though it was during a pandemic, it forced people, neighbors, to work together and really support each other because all we have are each other. And that's important. So it's been a stressful year. I'm really hoping that 2021 is a lot boring, very boring.
It's a great year.
And hope we get life back to normal pandemic-wise here, you know, in the coming months and stuff. Continue to support the health department on vaccination clinics and those types of things.
Okay.
We've really been challenged with getting, you know, adequate supplies, you know, on those things. So hopefully those supplies will increase so that we can do more vaccinations and that kind of stuff. And they're experiencing a lot of the stuff with vaccine and stuff that we experienced in the very beginning and the emergency management with PPE and that kind of stuff. So it's been a very frustrating year for a lot of us, but we're really doing a really good job here in Midland County, you know, given the situation we're in and the resources we have. We're really doing a great job. So I think it's really important that our residents are aware of that and are appreciative of that, even though they don't see behind the scenes, us pulling out our hair and yelling, why, those types of things. We're really doing an amazing job servicing our community.
And I want to say again, as someone now, admittedly, I was only moderately hit by, I lost my basement, which is rough, but I know there were other people who went back and their home was gone. But and I was impacted professionally too. And I want to say that, you know, as a flood victim there, I want to say a big thank you, because I just, you know, people coming through and knocking on doors at 11 o'clock at night as we wait for water to rush down upon us, the waste crews who were just, I can only imagine what they were dealing with at that time, going back and forth. And my street looked like we were, you know, constructing barriers between our sidewalk and our street, purposely, man-size, 6-foot barriers. So I know that a lot of people understand that this was a big thing, and people are working hard and doing wonderful things even through this, both community, civically. It's been a thing. So if we can switch gears really quickly, I just have a couple of quick questions. One thing that I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned you had a daughter and kind of talked about the early days of the flood. I'm always curious to ask people about education in 2020, because we know the schools are working so hard, you know, trying to make sure that people have options and viable options. How has it been with your daughter's education? Are you doing in person, at home? What's going on?
That's been very challenging. So I'm an essential worker. So, I mean, I have to be working regardless of where it's at. She really does well with structure. The community that we lived in chose a week or two before our school was supposed to start that they were not going to be opening for school. I planner by profession. My husband had to return to work by the time. You know, one of us just can't take time off. So, you know, we're a two household income family, and he had some time off for a little while, but thankfully we had, you know, that additional federal help with unemployment and everything. So that was a blessing for us, but we couldn't continue on and grandparents, they're great grandparents, but they also, you know, are vulnerable and don't really want to have any more interactions. They have to, and she needed some structure and someone to help her with school. So we actually, my daughter had to switch school districts this year, which was really big for her. We decided to do that. So we switched school districts. So the school district that we switched her to has offered in-person learning pretty much since the beginning of school year. She's had to do remote learning because of they either closed with the governor, you know, they made a decision to close not knowing what the governor was going to say 3 days later, or because her teacher, you know, I think at one time was exposed or whatever. So she had to do remote learning. So we worked with those periods. In that, you know, thankfully I'm one of those that, you know, it is 40 hours a week, but I'm usually working more than 40 hours a week, and I'm able to work from pretty much anywhere because my job makes me work from pretty much anywhere. I mean, there's been times I've had to work from the side of the road to handle things, you know, so it's been pretty flexible. And my husband's very supportive. I'm like, I gotta go, you know. So, but it's been challenging for her personally with the changes, going to a new school, not having, you know, making new friends while you're wearing a mask and social distancing for a third grader and other children. That's gotta be very, very challenging to be in that environment. She's had some rough days, but we've persevered through them. I'm very, very proud of her. She'd have to go for at least a full semester and see how they were doing and seeing how that was, and then maybe change the semester. Given how things have gone the last couple of months, we have committed to her staying in this school district for the rest of the year. I've been fortunate enough with my work to have some flexibility in getting her to and from school, because aftercare programs, you know, they don't have the capacity they used to have. And again, out of district, at a last minute type of thing. So been working through all of that. So it has been challenging, but now things, you know, seem to be smoothing out a little bit. She's, you know, she misses her friends, but she's also made new friends. She still interacts with her old friends, you know, with tablets and games and stuff and phone calls and everything. You know, she's been able, and, you know, she does a lot of virtual FaceTime calls with her friends and different things. So that has continued. She's continued to have those relationships and everything. So hopefully next year we can get back to, you know, her old school district and everything. But it's impacted us, you know, in every way possible at home and with her and stuff. So, but she understands kind of my job and different things and responsibility I have and how I'm helping others. And really trying to make sure people are safe. And there's been times she's had to come with me, and I'm fortunate she's very well behaved, so I can sit her in an office with somebody here, give her a book to read or whatever. But, you know, there's been some times too that it's been very challenging, you know, especially when I was working from home. There's a couple of days where I was Zooming for 7 hours, meeting after meeting after meeting, and you know, don't even get a chance to get a cup of coffee or a bathroom break, let alone, you know, get a lunch for a child or something. So,
yeah.
So there's been some very challenging days. And we've just been able to be flexible and kind of roll with it. We do the best we can with what we have. So, but yeah, very challenging. And I know other parents out there, you know, they've all had similar challenges and different things. So, but one day at a time, right?
Yep. One of the best things I've done a number of these oral histories starting even before the flood, and then a little bit into the summer, and then we were dealing with too much flood stuff and everything at work. But one of the greatest things, one of the best lines that I had, one of the individuals I was talking to say is, every morning she got up and she just planned to fail gracefully. And I use that, you know, on a daily basis myself. I'm just going to fail gracefully today.
Yeah. Yeah. With our colleagues and stuff, we've always, we send each other jokes and memes and different things. And one of our neighboring communities I'm pretty close with that emergency management coordinator. And there's one day I called and I sang to him that morning. I'm like, I'm just trying to get through the day. But it's nice to, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with other colleagues and stuff just to help reframe your perspective and get you kind of out of the weeds. I remember there's a few times others have called me and I have called themselves with this problem and frustrated, and they were able to like pull me back and say, okay, this, and this. I'm like, oh, wow, it's so much easier now. And I think all of us probably have had to do that, but there's been sometimes I've been really silly with, you know, calling people and different things, just trying to provide some mental health to them and just having someone to lean on during some of these challenge times, especially someone that's in a position similar to mine professionally that understands everything. It's one thing to go home to your husband and complain, but it's another one to complain to someone that's in your shoes a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on. So again, relationships are really important in this position, everybody, but also just personally, just to handle the stress and be able to disconnect when you need to disconnect and those types of things. So yeah, it's definitely, I always say that in 17, I was relatively new here. I was only here about a year or so. And that event, if I didn't have a relationship with someone at the time, I established a relationship with them at that time. So there were some times where it was very hard to establish relationships because there's a lot of things that we deal with that there's a lot of trust there. Trust that you know what you're doing, trust that you can do what you say you're going to do, a lot of that stuff in what I work with. So when you're in the thick of it and you can see how it's working and what's not working and knowing that you're there and you're committed to whatever needs to be done, that's huge. And that really gave me an opportunity to, I think, build the relationships I needed.
Yeah.
To set me up to be successful with this last event. I remember when I started talking about doing this Danfler response plan with some people, I heard some eyes rolling in different things because they're like, why are we gonna spend all this time? This is never gonna happen. But we learned a lot through it. And then after it happened, a few of those people have since come up and given me a hug and said, thank you for being a pain in my butt. Because they would have never imagined it. And it wasn't something that was on their radar. And personally, everybody has their different beliefs and stuff. And so I think sometimes we're put on a path. And after the dam failure, I really started thinking about my career and different things and looking back on the different projects I've had. Even before coming to Midland, I'd done some exercising with dams. I got familiar with the dam safety program of the state. There's just, and then, you know, me pushing to work with Boise Hydro on their planning and understanding that everybody understood their plan and that we all understood how we were going to respond and that kind of stuff, pushing through that. A couple people just said, why are we doing this? It's just, it's frustrating different things. And I almost feel like this was my path. Like I was meant to be here at this time to get the community through this, which I don't know if people may be offended by that or whatever, but it's really scary sometimes look back to see all the steps that were taken that put me here and for me to be in here with a certain perspective on certain things to prepare some of our people for this. It's really, really crazy to think. And kind of scary, you know. So hopefully there's no more big plans for me for a while. I've been praying that for boredom for the next 5-10 years or so.
I don't know how much bigger it could get.
I've had more more big events in my career than most people have within 20 or 30 years working in this type of position and stuff. So I feel like my box has been checked with disasters and everything, and even for the community. But it's really, really interesting looking back on things and how life has changed and how things have gone and where we are now. And I'm excited about going forward with a lot of people. I've, you know, developed some really good friendships out of professional relationships and stuff through this process. Some people know more about me than they want to after being with me 12 hours a day in the emergency operations center. But it's good. It's a community here.
That actually, so that brings me really wonderfully, and I think you may have kind of answered it, but to my last question, I like to ask people, think of somebody 50 years from now. It's kind of, you know, final thought. Think of somebody 50 years from now. They're 30 years old. The pandemic, the flood had nothing to do with them, but they're watching this video or listening to the audio of it or whatever they're doing in 50 years. And they're trying to write a book on Mid-Michigan in 2020. What do you want them to take away?
I think it's important to, you know, hindsight's always 2020. So reflecting back on this, I probably have a little bit of a different perspective on things I did going into it, right? So I think it's really important that it'd be nice to kind of see a picture into 30 years from now with the community and stuff to see how things have changed. But I think no matter what, whenever you are, whatever time you're in, I think it's really important that residents get involved in their community. Also get involved, like, you know, at their townships or whatever, even be present there. You know, I've kind of heard, you know, some people are like, well, no one knocked on my door and told me that I was going to be flooded from the dam failure, but there's opportunities that were out there for people to get information. So there's a lot of information that local governments have and that they even talk about and share at meetings and different things that I think a lot of people aren't even aware of. And I understand people are busy, but, you know, in order to make our community, our lives better, you know, we need to work with local governments and stuff to do that. And a lot of it's about information, informing yourself, right? Informing yourself of hazards and risks and that kind of stuff from my perspective, but just informing yourself of why we're doing what we're doing or why we pay these taxes. It's because you're getting services. So I would just hope that from this, maybe more people get involved into what's going on locally within city government, township governance, even the village and stuff, because it's really up to the community as a whole to move forward. It's not on one entity, it's on multiple entities. And it'd be really interesting to know what did we really learn from all this and implement going forward? Did we really focus on mitigation and removing stuff from the floodplain and mitigating that hazard and building, you know, away from the floodplain? Or did we continue to, I guess, make the same mistakes over and over again?
Yeah.
I don't know if that really answers your question.
No, it does. I think that's an excellent point. And the I like that you talked about looking into the future and hoping to see, because I think, you know, when I ask people about, you know, what do you want people to take away? I like the idea that hopefully somebody already took it away.
Yeah.
To get involved, to be there.
Like they have, you know, there's a big push to rebuild the dams. And I think that's a really important thing for our community to rebuild the dams. But what are we doing with that rebuilding? Mm-hmm. Are we still talking about potential issues of the dam? We still have significant rain events. Are we going to be doing community exercises of dam failures? Are we going to be doing, you know, public preparedness events regarding that area and the significance of that? Because I always tell people I'm a day away from a flood in Midland. Because all we need to do is have rain in the system to stop or stall over us, and then it's flooding. And you know what, when I first took the position, like, oh, you know, the springtime, there's a lot of flood, and in the fall, well, it hasn't flooded in here in the springtime. It's been the summertime, and we've had some significant rain events, you know, throughout the course of the years. So it's almost like there's no good time to like go on vacation or anything, or spring break. But I think I just hope that this last year people have learned a lot about preparedness, personal preparedness, and be better equipped for future emergencies, better prepared.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. That was, I can tell you that I learned an awful lot through that. So I really appreciate your time here, and I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
Without your position, the flood would have looked, and without you in your position, the flood would have looked a lot different. So, and the pandemic probably.
Well, I appreciate you thinking of me. I'm kind of, you know, backstage crew of productions and stuff that go on, you know, we're always in the background making things safe and happen and stuff. So I appreciate the recognition and the interest in really finding out more and how, you know, our office and myself has dealt with the last year or so and continues to deal with things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want to say that I think most of the community understands.